Chapter 3. The Disaster. The guest house is clean and plainly decorated. This is how the Sheikh likes it. Bin Laden sits on the floor with a group of followers in turbans and military fatigues. The topic of the conversation is the same one still preoccupying newsrooms and dinner tables around the globe: the tumultuous events of the past few weeks in New York, in Washington, D.C., in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and now here in Afghanistan. A former mujahid, a man who fought the Russians in the 1980s and the Serbs in the 1990s, addresses bin Laden. "Everybody praises what you did," he says. "This is the guidance of God and the blessed fruit of jihad." The man is paralyzed from the waist down, the result, he says, of wounds suffered in Bosnia. This, rather than any superiority of rank, explains why he did not get up when the Sheikh entered the room. But his disability has not stopped him from traveling more than 1,500 miles from Saudi Arabia to be among the mujahideen at this crucial time. Nor is he the only one to have made the journey. "Few only would follow you until this huge event happened," the paraplegic veteran goes on, warming to his theme. "Now hundreds of people are coming out to join you. The only ones who stay behind will be the mentally impotent and the hypocrites. God has bestowed honor on us, and He will give us blessing and more victory during this holy month of Ramadan." In New York, rescuers are pulling human remains from the wreckage strewn over several city blocks. Lower Manhattan is still wreathed in wraiths of acrid smoke. All over America, all over the world, families, communities, even whole countries are in mourning. The Sheikh grins. "Thanks be to God," he says. Terrorists have long viewed civilian airliners as tempting targets. Indeed, the first fatal terrorist hijacking took place as early as 1947, and the first clearly politically motivated airline bombing, an unsuccessful attempt to assassinate the Chinese premier Zhou Enlai, was in 1955. Various groups used such tactics to deadly effect in the 1970s and 1980s, from the tarmac in Beirut, Entebbe, and Tehran, to the skies over Lockerbie, Scotland. In June 1985, the Hezbollah hijackers of TW-8 Flight 847 even claimed to be suicide terrorists and threatened to crash the jet into the airport's control tower or Lebanon's presidential palace. But in their case, it was just a ploy to get permission to land. Deliberately using a plane as a weapon, a guided missile in all but name, would be something new and terrifying under the sun. The idea had crossed the minds of Al-Qaeda-linked operatives long before September 2001. Before leaving Egypt for the Soviet jihad, Colonel Ibrahim Makawi, the man so frequently mistaken for Saif al-Adl, had mused about the possibility of crashing aircraft into the Egyptian House of Representatives in Cairo. Many of Makawi's jihadi colleagues from this period dismissed him as a dangerous crackpot. A few years later, Ramzi Youssef, disappointed by his own failure to destroy the Twin Towers in the 1993 bombing, would consider aiming a private plane at CIA headquarters outside Washington, D.C. But the 9/11 attacks began in the fevered imagination of Youssef's uncle, the Pakistani terrorist facilitator Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. KSM had long been interested in attacking the United States, and his plots and fantasies often involved airliners. As a teenager growing up in Kuwait, he had reportedly written a play about bringing down American planes. Later, after obtaining his bachelor's degree in North Carolina, KSM joined his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, in the failed plot against CIA headquarters, another facet of which was to involve blowing up passenger aircraft en route from Asia to the United States. Following stints in the Philippines, Bosnia, and Qatar, KSM moved to Afghanistan at the beginning of 1996, a few months ahead of Al-Qaeda. Shortly after bin Laden's declaration of jihad against the United States that August, KSM described for the Sheikh his fiery vision of jetliners plowing into American skyscrapers and smashing the neoclassical palaces of the U.S. federal government. He called it the Plains Operation. In its complexity and brutality, the plot far outstripped anything yet attempted by any terrorist organization. If Al-Qaeda could pull it off, it would put even the devastating East Africa embassy bombings in the shade. In fact, the planes operation would become overnight the new yardstick by which all future terror attacks would be judged. It is not feasible, Bin Laden told Khalid Sheikh Mohammed when he first raised the planes operation in the fall of 1996. Nevertheless, he invited the Pakistani to join Al-Qaeda. The organization could make use of a member with his diabolical imagination. KSM politely declined. But between about 1996 and 1999, he continued to curry favor with the Al-Qaeda leadership, deploying his technical skills to help his old contact Saif al-Adl with certain computer and media projects and other tasks. As the latter half of the 1990s wore on, KSM's nightmare vision grew steadily more vivid in the mind of the Sheikh. Ideologically, Bin Laden reasoned, it was right and proper to take any opportunity to strike his main enemy, the United States. The harder the better. American troops still lingered on the Arabian Peninsula. Moreover, an attack on Israel's principal backer would show support for the Palestinian cause, something that became especially pressing with the start of the Second Intifada in September 2000. 7 years after the first such period of violent Israeli-Palestinian conflict had ended, as with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan 20 years before, the sound and fury of the attacks would draw hundreds of fresh fighters to Bin Laden's banners. In the mind of the Sheikh, these unprecedented atrocities would make Al-Qaeda unquestionably the premier Islamist group in the world. But the plan still faced powerful resistance. The Taliban's commander of the faithful, Mullah Omar, had made known his opposition to major attacks directly against the United States. Such operations, he feared, would risk drawing the superpower into Afghanistan's civil war, something the Taliban could do without, especially while they were making tentative headway against their Northern Alliance antagonists. Many among Bin Laden's senior lieutenants were sympathetic towards this point of view and wanted to defer to the wishes of their hosts. Afghanistan was, after all, the Taliban's country. However much they might express admiration for Bin Laden and solidarity with the aims of his organization. And for better or worse, the Sheikh had pledged his allegiance to their leader, Mullah Omar. Bin Laden was unpersuaded. He countered that there was no need to defer to the Taliban on this matter. Surely his pledge of bayat extended only as far as Afghanistan's borders. It could not hamper actions halfway around the world on a different continent. Moreover, there was nothing for the Taliban to object to. In fact, they ought to be grateful. The attacks, like previous operations, would attract more recruits, larger donations, and greater assistance from sympathetic foreigners. Al-Qaeda would continue assisting their hosts by sending fighters to the war front, and it had recently been decided by carrying out a plot to assassinate the Northern Alliance's supreme commander, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Besides, the Sheikh said, the Americans were not coming. They would never put an invasion force in Afghanistan. They would do what they always did, lob a few cruise missiles at a few camps, maybe carry out a couple of airstrikes, then retreat. A handful of militants might die, but they would perish as martyrs. The better to drum up fresh recruits seeking paths of glory. At the very most, Bin Laden thought, the United States might send a commando detachment to capture or kill him. If that happened, he had a plan to thwart the raid and humiliate the great enemy by luring the Americans to their deaths in the mountains of Tora Bora, just as he had done with Soviet special forces at Jaji 14 years before. Even if, by some twist of fate, the United States did come in force, what had the Mujahideen to fear? Were not the roads of Afghanistan lined to this day with dead Soviet tanks? Had not Bin Laden's own cherished Kalashnikov been stripped from the corpse of a Russian officer? The Mujahideen would crush the Americans, just as they defeated the Russians. And as the forebears of today's Afghans had seen off the British, the Mongols, the Persians, the Greeks, not for nothing has Afghanistan been called the graveyard of empires. The Sheikh knew from experience just how much damage one could inflict on a superpower among the high places of the Hindu Kush. He had inflicted no small portion of that damage himself. In any case, the American soldier, as bin Laden had always said, was weak, unfit for real combat. In fact, the United States, a democracy whose people had shown little appetite for wars of attrition, might fold even faster than the Russians, and Osama bin Laden, vanquisher of empires, would in that moment become a saint. It must be acknowledged that in light of America's record in the years preceding 9/11, this view was not without justification. As bin Laden himself had pointed out in his 1996 declaration of jihad, U.S. forces had withdrawn from Lebanon within 4 months of the 1983 barracks bombing. A decade later, they had followed more or less the same timetable in getting out of Somalia in the aftermath of the Battle of Mogadishu. The bombing of the World Trade Center that same year, masterminded by KSM's nephew, a man who had trained in the Afghan camps, had produced criminal investigations but no real retaliation. Subsequent experience seemed to confirm, in the minds of many jihadis, America's fecklessness. In response to the East Africa bombings, in which a dozen Americans died, the United States had launched Operation Infinite Reach. Cruise missiles rained down on targets in Sudan and Afghanistan, but failed to inflict any lasting harm on Al-Qaeda. And even these minimal strikes had cost the Clinton administration disproportionate political capital. They had doubtful military merit and had occurred just 3 days after President Clinton had admitted inappropriate intimate contact with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. 2 years later, following the USS Cole attack, many in Al-Qaeda, including Saif al-Adl, had expected and prepared for tougher reprisals, but none came. By the time it became clear that bin Laden had been behind the suicide bombing, America's attention was on the recent presidential election, which was hurrying toward resolution in the Supreme Court. Neither the outgoing Clinton administration nor its successor harbored much appetite for a retaliatory strike against Al-Qaeda at anything like the level of intensity that would be necessary to disrupt the organization. Al-Qaeda could survive indefinitely this pattern of American action, or more frequently, inaction. In fact, in terms of propaganda, fundraising, and especially recruitment, the biggest attacks on America had so far raked in the biggest benefits. It is also worth noting that prior to the attacks themselves, nobody in Al-Qaeda believed that they would cause the Twin Towers to collapse. Bin Laden would later say that he was the most optimistic of all when it came to the predicted level of destruction. But even he, drawing upon his experience in the construction industry, only expected the top few floors to fall. The level of destruction eventually visited upon New York City exceeded even the wildest of KSM's warped dreams. Even so, the old soldier Saif al-Adl viewed the matter differently. It was not that he cared deeply about civilian casualties. In fact, Abu Jandal was to note that, among all of Al-Qaeda's senior leaders, Saif seemed least affected by the deaths of innocent civilians. But Saif could see that KSM's hellish vision would be qualitatively different from hitting an embassy in a foreign capital or a warship in a faraway harbor. A strike on the U.S. homeland on the scale of the Plains operation would represent a provocation orders of magnitude greater than either of these strikes. If ever there was an intervention that could cure America of Vietnam syndrome, this was it. With his military experience and his pragmatic frame of mind, Saif was perhaps better placed than any of his colleagues in Al-Qaeda's upper echelons to foresee the disaster that would befall the organization if the Americans were to put their full might into the response. As Saif's father-in-law, Mustafa Hamid, told bin Laden, "The problem is not how to start the war, but how to win the war." If the Americans invaded, Saif knew Al-Qaeda would face ruin, not just in Afghanistan but around the world. There was no viable plan for defending the Islamic Emirate against a concerted American onslaught. If the Taliban fell, what other government would step in to harbor the jihadists? And in any event, why risk destroying what Al-Qaeda regarded as the only true Islamic state on earth? as for bin Laden's plan to lure U.S. troops to destruction at his mountain lair, to Saif's mind, this was sheer insanity. Tora Bora was not Jaji. And the United States was not the Soviet Union. Far from being a good place to spring a clever trap, any tactician worth his salt could see that the isolated cave complex would be acutely vulnerable to heavy aerial bombardment and a protracted siege, a strategy that would massively favor the Americans with their unbridgeable advantages in manpower, technology, and logistics. If the Kefir soldiers did not seal up the passes, sooner or later the winter snows would take care of that for them. Surely starvation in the mountains, or for that matter, incineration from above, was not the kind of glorious martyrdom Osama bin Laden had in mind. A majority of al-Qaeda's Shura Council sided with Saif al-Adl against the planes operation. In fact, besides bin Laden himself, only Zawahiri and his new Egyptians came down in favor of the strikes. Abu Hafs al-Muratani, the religious head of al-Qaeda, wrote bin Laden a letter couching his opposition in Quranic terms. Even Abu Hafs al-Masri, al-Qaeda's military chief, came out in opposition. But bin Laden had convinced himself of the righteousness of KSM's wild plan, and that was all that mattered. "I will make it happen," the Sheikh told his followers, "even if I do it by myself." In March or April 1999, bin Laden gave KSM the green light to proceed with the plane's operation. A few months later, another event fired the Sheikh's imagination still further. The October 1999 Egypt Air disaster, in which a suicidal co-pilot deliberately downed his plane in the Atlantic Ocean, killing himself and 216 others en route from New York to Cairo. According to the Yemeni al-Qaeda leader, Nasser al-Wuhashi, bin Laden felt that the co-pilot should have crashed into a building instead. Privately, bin Laden's obstinacy in the face of sensible counsel frustrated Saif al-Adl. "If someone opposes him," Saif wrote, "he immediately puts forward another person to render an opinion in his support, clinging to his opinion and totally disregarding those around him. So there is no advice nor anything." Once the decision was made, however, the doubters, as usual, fell into line. Saif, like the good soldier he was, now helped plan the very attacks he had opposed. At the same time, anticipating the rain of fire that 9/11 would call down, Saif began scouting for locations in which to shelter al-Qaeda's leaders in the aftermath. He soon concluded that their safest hiding place would be the Pakistani tribal stronghold of Waziristan. In the run-up to the attacks, in August of 2001, Saif was appointed to lead the defense of the al-Qaeda and Taliban citadel of Kandahar, together with its nearby airport and training camps. He began his preparations around 2 weeks before the attacks, with 75 fighters under his command, a number that would soon swell exponentially. Saif ordered trenches dug along a 4-mile front around the airport and the Farouk camp, and set traps to ensnare approaching enemy vehicles and men. He split the city into 5 sectors, 1 in the center and 4 around the outskirts. In addition, he created a rapid deployment force mounted on Toyota pickup trucks. The Toyotas, Saif found, were stealthy and highly maneuverable, whether in the mountains or on the flat plains. "If the Japanese had seen the vehicles in action," Saif said, "they would have used them for marketing advertisements." Not every item in al-Qaeda's arsenal was as impressive, however. Much of the militants' weaponry, like most of the materiel in Afghanistan, dated back to the Soviet era. Alongside the ubiquitous grenade belts and AK-47 assault rifles in various states of repair, Saif's men possessed shoulder-fired Strela II surface-to-air missiles, a tank nicknamed the Elephant, and an ancient Chinese-made 12-tube BM rocket launcher of the kind that had earned Abdul Rahman BM, the father of the girl who had become Khalid bin Laden's fiancée, his nickname. In place of field radios, or the useful but easily traceable satellite phones, Saif created lines of communication using human couriers mounted on motorcycles or even on horseback. When it came to zeal, his men wanted for nothing, and a commitment born of absolute faith goes a long way. Even so, Saif al-Adel, the military realist, might not have liked his chances against American air superiority and special forces prowess. At the beginning of September, bin Laden gathered all the residents of Tarnak Farm at the mosque. "An operation is about to happen," he told them. "We will be evacuating this compound." This much was by now familiar protocol. As with previous attacks, bin Laden got into a car, this time heading north, accompanied by his son Uthman, and a laptop bag full of U.S. dollars. To minimize the very real threat of a decapitation strike, Saif al-Adel had instructed bin Laden's bodyguards to keep him on the move between safe houses in Kabul and Jalalabad. Saif said farewell to his sheikh and got back to firming up the defenses for the coming war. In order to appease Mullah Omar and the Taliban leadership, Saif and others had hatched a plan to kill the Northern Alliance Supreme Commander, Ahmed Shah Massoud. It was hoped that Massoud's death would disorient the enemy and pave the way for a final Taliban takeover of all territory still held by the alliance. The killers were to enter Massoud's camp, posing as documentary filmmakers seeking to interview the commander. As part of their cover, the attackers would claim to be Belgians of Moroccan origin. In fact, they were Tunisians, but had spent some time in Molenbeek, the Brussels neighborhood that was home to many of the Islamic State terrorists who attacked Paris in November 2015 and Brussels in March 2016. When they sat down for the interview, the assassins would explode a suicide belt and a booby-trapped battery pack, with the intention of killing themselves and Massoud. Saif arranged for the assassins to be trained for this mission by the man who had built the two East Africa truck bombs, while bin Laden's deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, forged letters of introduction in clumsy French, a language Massoud knew from having been educated at an elite French-run school in Kabul, to get the phony journalists admitted to Massoud's presence. Around the same time Saif al-Adel began sinking trenches at the Kandahar airport, the assassins were entering the Northern Alliance camp 400 miles away to the northeast. 2 weeks later, on September 9th, they finally sat down with Massoud. One of the men told the translator his three opening questions, each of which concerned Massoud's assumed enmity for bin Laden. Before the first question could be translated, the assassins exploded their devices with a burst of blue flame, piercing Massoud's heart with shards of metal. The blast blew one of the assassins apart. The other escaped, only to be captured and killed by Massoud's bodyguards. Within minutes, in the back of a car sent to speed him to the nearest field hospital, Massoud himself was dead. 2 days later, at airports in the northeastern United States, 19 hijackers boarded their final flights. Together, they murdered nearly 3,000 civilians and first responders. "Those young men," bin Laden told his followers, "said in deeds in New York and Washington, speeches that overshadowed all other speeches made everywhere else in the world." At a stroke, Osama bin Laden, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Saif al-Adel, and all who had participated in planning and carrying out the planes operation took their places among the most prolific mass murderers in global terrorism. Saif al-Adel estimated that in the aftermath of 9/11, more than 2,000 fighters rallied to Afghanistan from all over the world, equivalent to five times al-Qaeda's total strength worldwide at that time. These men did not necessarily become formal al-Qaeda members, but they gathered under bin Laden's standard nonetheless. Most of the new recruits probably came looking for yet another tourist jihad. Like bin Laden, they would have expected the United States, as in the past, to make a show of force with some missiles, and then move on. The tourists would get to feel the heat of explosions, maybe take a few pot shots at some planes, then return home to tell their war stories and bask in the adulation of their friends. Lists began circulating for volunteers to register their interest in al-Qaeda's martyrdom brigades, those to be used as suicide bombers against the enemy. By the end of October, 120 men had signed up. around the same number that Al-Qaeda had fighting the Northern Alliance before 9/11. But this was not going to be like previous attacks. In Washington, President Bush had been granted congressional authority for all necessary and appropriate military force to bring justice to the perpetrators. In Brussels, for the first time in its history, the powerful NATO alliance invoked Article 5 of its founding treaty, obliging all members to assist the United States. Across the world, public opinion rallied behind America. A military coalition was taking shape, the likes of which had not been seen in decades. Soon, Afghan towns from Kabul to Herat would start falling to the Northern Alliance, backed up by the United States and its allies. In a matter of weeks, the enemy would be at the gates of Kandahar itself. This was no tourist jihad. The serpent had emerged from its burrow. Now, it was baring its fangs. Knowing only too well what lay over the horizon, Saif al-Adl set about evacuating Kandahar. He ordered one of his fighters, an alumnus of the East African attacks, to take some Arab families across the border to safety in Iran, where Saif had arranged for their arrival and protection with his contacts among the Quds force. "Get in your truck right away and take the families," he told the man. The fighter was incredulous. "Why are you sending me?" he protested. In his hand, the man brandished a copy of Time magazine, showing his own face, beside those of Saif al-Adl, Osama bin Laden, and 19 others America had named on its first-ever public list of most wanted terrorists. "I'm wanted by the Americans," the man protested. "I have millions of dollars on my head because of the embassy bombings." He pleaded to be sent to safety in Pakistan instead, but Saif had no time for special pleading. "I am ordering you," he said. "Go." On October 7th, 2001, the first night of coalition aerial bombardment, explosions rocked Al-Qaeda camps near Kandahar and Kabul. Later, Saif drove to Tarnak Farm to survey the damage. Over the course of just a few hours of bombing, fully one quarter of the 80 family homes had been reduced to rubble. Soon, the compound would be, for practical purposes, completely destroyed. Raids on targets in and around Kandahar intensified still further after U.S. Marines seized a landing strip around 80 miles distant. Saif watched as the skies above the city filled with fast jets, B-52 high-altitude bombers, Apache helicopter gunships, cruise missiles, and perhaps most worryingly of all, C-130 Hercules heavy lifters of the type used to mount airborne howitzer cannons and to deliver the U.S. military's heaviest ordnance. These war machines waged, in Saif's words, a stormy campaign. He could identify them all, and he knew what they meant for him and his men. Nor was there much encouragement to be gleaned out of news from elsewhere in Afghanistan. On November 9th, U.S. precision bombs hit Taliban positions in the northern town of Mazar-i-Sharif. From out of the smoke of these explosions, there came galloping, almost incredibly, the first massed cavalry charge of the 21st century. Hundreds of Northern Alliance horsemen, riding alongside American special operators, soon overran the city. Within a day, it had fallen to the coalition. 4 days later, the Northern Alliance took the Afghan capital, Kabul. Herat, the city where Saif al-Adl had helped create a camp for the Jordanian militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, fell the same day, forcing Saif's father-in-law, Mustafa Hamid, to flee over the border into Iran. Zarqawi himself also fled, eventually to link up with his mentor once more in Kandahar. Barely 2 months since the plane's operation, Al-Qaeda and its Taliban allies had already lost functional control of the entire northern half of Afghanistan. At this moment of crisis, Saif al-Adl was suddenly thrust even further to the fore. On the night of November 15th, coalition missiles hit the home of Al-Qaeda's military chief, Abu Hafs al-Mazri, crumbling it into a pile of stones at the bottom of a deep crater. While most Al-Qaeda commanders had evacuated, Abu Hafs had been unable to do so because of a slipped disc in his back. He was crushed beneath the concrete of his own house. Nearby lay the corpse of another erstwhile colleague of Saif al-Adl's, the Tunisian who had shot down a Black Hawk helicopter over Mogadishu 8 years before. With Abu Hafs gone, Saif al-Adl was next in line to be al-Qaeda's military commander. Once again, the unlooked-for death of an al-Qaeda leader had spelled advancement for the Egyptian. But this battlefield promotion had come in the worst possible circumstances. In Kandahar, which was facing a ground war within weeks, there was no time to grieve. Saif convened an emergency meeting of senior Arab Afghans and Taliban leaders to firm up the city's defenses. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed attended, as did Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, fresh from the destruction of his camp at Herat. A number of senior figures from the other Arab groups operating out of Afghanistan also joined the gathering. Collectively, they appointed Saif al-Adl commander over all the Arab fighters in Kandahar, and for this limited purpose, they all gave bayat to al-Qaeda. Ironically, by creating an emergency on an unprecedented scale, 9/11 had, albeit indirectly, accomplished bin Laden's dream of uniting all the Arab groups under his banner. But this state of affairs would prove short-lived, for Kandahar was almost lost. Beneath a sky ablaze with bullets, bombs, shells, and missiles, Saif found it hard to sleep. It was the beginning of Ramadan, when observant Muslims abstain from eating and drinking during daylight hours. Little by little, the November days grew shorter. That was a mercy for the fighters' fasting stomachs, but it also meant more and more time between nightfall and sunrise, when the heaviest bombardment would happen. On November 19th, the third night of the fasting month, Saif woke after 1 a.m. in a state of anxiety. Fearing a direct hit was on the way, he swiftly ordered the fighters with him out of the house. But before they could leave, they heard an explosion far away across town. A cruise missile had struck the offices of Al-Wafa al-Ighatha al-Islamiyah, a terrorist front charity that had arranged for a number of militants, including the paraplegic mullah, to travel to Afghanistan following the attacks on America. Still shaken, Saif and the fighters sat down for suhoor, the pre-dawn breakfast. Toward the end of their meal, Saif heard another missile tear across the sky above, and this time, judging by the sound, it was much closer. The missile exploded just 300 feet from their door, shattering two houses at the end of the street. Saif and his companions ran out to see the smoking ruins. The aircraft that had fired the rocket lingered overhead, looking for further targets. Suddenly, it let loose a second trail of smoke and flame. Saif and the fighters dove for cover as the missile smashed into the middle of the street where they had been standing. Once the early morning sky was clear, the fighters picked themselves up and tramped over to one of Saif al-Adl's defensive positions. "Stay here," Saif told the fighters. He drove across town to the hospital to check on the casualties, then paid a visit to an al-Qaeda forward operating base. All over Kandahar, buildings lay in ruins or in flames. Warplanes swarmed overhead, hunting for fresh targets. Jets and rotors beat the air. Someone told Saif that the strike on Al-Wafa had slain one of his trainers from the Farouk camp. In a separate incident, two young children of an al-Qaeda fighter had been killed. Saif tried to comfort the grieving father. "Your children," he told the man, "will be brought to paradise on the day of resurrection, God willing." He then went to check on his own wife, Asma Hamid, and their five children, whom he had not seen in some time. They were unharmed. Worse was to come. Behind the ridgeline to the north of the city, U.S. special operators had already linked up with fighters loyal to a Pashtun politician and former Mujahideen fundraiser named Hamid Karzai. To the south, the forces of Gulag Ashurzai, Kandahar's once and future governor, encroached on the traps and trenches around the airport. Since September, Saif's defense force had swelled more than tenfold. 800 jihadi fighters now awaited his command, some at the airport, others in the city itself. But it was still by no means certain that the Taliban would back them up. On November 29th, with the two battle fronts rapidly approaching, Saif demanded an audience with Mullah Omar's private secretary. His question could not have been more urgent. Would the Taliban stand and fight, or would they withdraw, as they had done in Kabul and Herat? In the middle of the meeting, a missile exploded nearby. Without warning, the entire ceiling came crashing down on Saif, his companions, and the Taliban representatives. Astonishingly, all escaped serious injury. Shaken, bruised, and covered in dust, Saif and his companions pulled a number of Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants out of the rubble and brought them to safety. But the other news from the meeting was not as positive, for it was becoming increasingly apparent that the Taliban intended not to fight to keep Kandahar, but to negotiate for its surrender. Around the first day of December, halfway through Ramadan, one of Saif's men noticed a scout vehicle on a broken bridge near the airport. The man opened fire on the vehicle, and its occupants responded with a few volleys of their own before speeding away. It was then, as Saif would write later, that hell broke out in the area. Airplanes came from every direction and in all kinds. C-130s attacked, jets attacked with missiles, helicopters attacked with missiles and guns. The area was transformed into a ball of fire for more than an hour. Gulaga's Northern Alliance forces began to advance again, assured that there were no breathing souls left in the area other than their forces. As soon as they entered the killing field, bombs of the youngsters, Al-Qaeda fighters, rained on them from every direction, and they, Gulaga's men, were gunned down with machine guns. Calls of God is great and victory were screamed aloud. The brothers killed many of them and captured two. The rest fled. It was a success by the will of God Almighty. There followed 5 relentless days and nights of what Saif termed wild combat, alternating between coalition airstrikes and Northern Alliance ground offensives. Saif commandeered the Kandahar Religious Institute and had it set up as a field kitchen for Al-Qaeda fighters, serving 3 meals a day. The Egyptian commander could be seen speeding up and down the front lines, barking orders at the Arabs under his command who surrounded the city. Saif's strategy emphasized the need to confound the airborne enemy with small targets, constantly in motion. He had therefore divided his forces into many tight-knit mobile units. These cells roamed the city and the airport in trucks with missile and rocket launchers bolted to their flatbeds. B-52 bombers sailed overhead. 3 days into the fighting, a guided bomb destroyed the Chinese BM rocket launcher. Then, the tank called the Elephant took a direct hit from a missile. A number of fighters were killed in a fierce close-quarters battle on the roads around the airport, in which one Al-Qaeda commander could be seen, in Saif's words, harvesting the souls of the enemy. At times, however, Saif had difficulty controlling the militants under his command, who would get excited in the white heat of combat and abandon their assigned positions, or else waste scarce ammunition by shooting at aircraft wildly out of range of their weapons. Around the same time, speaking by satellite phone from his position with U.S. Special Forces north of Kandahar, Hamid Karzai addressed delegates at the Bonn Conference deciding the future of Afghanistan. On December 5th, even as Karzai continued his advance on the city, the conference named him the interim president of his country. Buoyed by this vote of confidence, Karzai demanded the unconditional surrender of Kandahar. In the days that ensued, many Taliban leaders, including Mullah Omar himself, bowed to the inevitable and fled to avoid capture or death. Al-Qaeda's senior leaders, too, began pouring out of the city. Reportedly, some 24 of them left together one day in a single convoy. On December 9th, Gul Aga's troops finally took the city, scattering its defenders and their commanders. Like his comrades and underlings, Saif al-Adl took to the hills. In the meantime, Osama bin Laden had done exactly what Saif al-Adl had warned him not to do. He had fled to the mountain enclave of Tora Bora. Still acting on the flawed theory that he could prime a trap there for Western forces to blunder into, the Sheikh even took a radio with him in an effort to give away his position on purpose. On top of all this, the base was woefully lacking in provisions. Instead of ordering its resupply in good time, bin Laden had, not uncharacteristically, prevaricated until the last moment. Day after day, the U.S. Air Force pounded Tora Bora with a relentless bombardment. On one occasion, the strikes lasted for 17 consecutive hours. On another, a C-130 Hercules, one of the largest planes in the U.S. arsenal, dropped a 7.5-ton daisy cutter bomb on the site, causing the mountains to tremble for miles around. Meanwhile, moving during the gaps between bombing raids, American Special Forces on the ground closed in. Before the battle was over, they had killed perhaps 250 Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other Arab fighters. On December 17th, barely 3 months after 9/11, Tora Bora fell. But bin Laden was neither captured nor discovered broken beneath the rubble, as the Americans had hoped. For by then, the Sheikh was long gone. Knowing defeat when he saw it, Saif al-Adl left the fires of Kandahar blazing behind him and fled. On December 8th, he reached Zermatt, close to the border with Waziristan, the Pakistani tribal region he had recommended as a place to lie low. A number of senior al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders gathered in the town, including Abu Muhammad al-Masri, who would later be Saif's prison mate in Iran. Over the next few days, Saif made his way through the mountains and over the border into Pakistan, where he was to spend the next few months in hiding. After the chaos of Kandahar and the days before its fall, Saif's stay in Pakistan must have come as a welcome respite. There, he enjoyed breathing space and even some time to relax. A fellow militant who visited him in this period remembers playing soccer with him one day before lunch. "He was a really good player," the man observed, "sharp and fast." But Pakistan would not remain a safe haven for long. The United States was putting the country's government under unprecedented pressure to round up al-Qaeda suspects seeking sanctuary on its soil. Over the course of 2002, the authorities began closing in, snatching militants from the streets of Pakistan's cities. In March, Abu Zubaydah, a conspirator in the Millennium Plots who had fought alongside Saif al-Adl in the twilight days of Kandahar, was arrested after a shootout in Faisalabad. 6 months later, and 1 year after 9/11, a key facilitator in the plane's operation, Ramzi bin al-Shib, was captured following another gun battle in a house with "There is no God but Allah" scrawled on the walls in blood. The following March, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself was picked up in Rawalpindi after someone in the building texted authorities to tell them he was there. Before being taken into custody, KSM had established a relationship between al-Qaeda and the gangs of smugglers who haunted his ancestral homeland of Baluchistan in southwestern Pakistan. In the wake of 9/11, these groups formed a pipeline to transport militants from their hiding places in Pakistan through Baluchistan and into Iran. To begin with, the Iranian National Guard had turned a blind eye to the Arabs fleeing over the border. However, after an understandable outcry from the local population, Iranian intelligence had rounded up the militants and their families and deported them, either back to Pakistan or onward to their home countries. Clearly, Iran was not the safe haven some in al-Qaeda had thought. But the militants still hiding in Pakistan, hunted and harried by the authorities, were out of options. In the months that followed the first wave of mass deportations, a second group of al-Qaeda members and families moved into Iran and spread out between a number of cities. As part of this second wave, Saif hid out in Shiraz, in the southwest, with his old jihadi brothers-in-arms, Abu Khair and Abu Muhammad al-Masri, under the protection of local al-Qaeda sympathizers. At first, Saif and his Arab colleagues were allowed to live in Iran, free but closely monitored. The authorities even helped some of the new arrivals get settled in the country. But Mustafa Hamid, who had been in Iran himself since having been forced out of Afghanistan after the fall of Herat, correctly speculated that the Iranians were simply biding their time, using the hiatus to gather as much intelligence as possible about the Arabs newly arrived on their soil. Sooner or later, the authorities would have to clamp down. Around the close of 2002, operating out of an al-Qaeda safe house in Iran, Saif al-Adl received word that al-Qaeda's cell in Saudi Arabia was negotiating to buy 3 Russian nuclear weapons. For the United States and its allies, this was the nightmare scenario. In terms of its capacity for destruction and horror, a nuclear atrocity would outdo even 9/11. For al-Qaeda, however, this lead on a clutch of loose nukes represented an opportunity to prove its enduring strength following the Afghan debacle. If you can obtain such a weapon, Saif told the cell's leadership, no price is too high to pay. Still, he counseled caution. Al-Qaeda had been fooled by fakes before. Saif therefore advised his operatives in the kingdom to fly in a Pakistani nuclear scientist to check that the devices were genuine. Western intelligence, eavesdropping on these communications, took the potential threat seriously enough to share it not only with their Saudi counterparts, but also, exceptionally, with the Iranians themselves. Around the same time, the Saudi cell was preparing plans of a more traditional terrorist nature. In an encrypted phone call in early March of 2003, around the time Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was being taken into American custody in Rawalpindi and the U.S. invasion of Iraq was getting underway, Saif reportedly gave the cell's leaders the order to proceed with the campaign of conventional bombings inside Saudi Arabia. It has been reported that the Saudi authorities intercepted Saif's encrypted phone call and furiously demanded that Iran take action to stop the Al-Qaeda leadership now operating from Iranian territory. Whatever steps were taken, they were not enough to prevent the deaths of more than 36 people in suicide attacks on residential compounds in Riyadh used by foreign workers. And although Al-Qaeda has never officially claimed responsibility, these strikes certainly bore the organization's grimly familiar fingerprints. Finally, around April of 2003, the Al-Qaeda members in Iran realized that they were being watched and began taking steps to evade Iranian monitoring. This discovery at last forced the authorities' hand. Fearing that Al-Qaeda might slip through their fingers, Iranian intelligence moved in. According to Mustafa Hamid, the ensuing dragnet pulled in practically every Al-Qaeda operative in the country, together with many of their families. Saif al-Adl was arrested on April 23rd, along with the companions who were living with him in the Shiraz safe house, Abu Khair and Abu Muhammad. Al-Qaeda's military commander was to spend almost the next 7 years in captivity. Saif al-Adl had served in the Egyptian armed forces. He had battled the Soviets as one of the Arab-Afghan Mujahideen, fought United Nations troops in Somalia, and commanded the defense of Kandahar against the combined might of NATO and the Northern Alliance. For more than a decade, he had helped lead one of the most feared terrorist groups in the world, training militants, protecting the Sheikh, organizing terror cells, planning assassinations. From such a seasoned operative, there could be no hiding the scale of the disaster that had befallen Al-Qaeda in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Abu Hafs al-Masri, its supreme military commander, lay dead. By Saif's own reckoning, more than 500 Arab Afghans, including many Al-Qaeda members, had either been killed or had fled. Others had been captured, in Afghanistan or over the border in Pakistan. Some of them now languished in American custody at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The surviving members of the Shura Council were scattered. Bin Laden and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, had gone on the run. The immediate aftermath of the fall of the Taliban was, to a practical man like Saif al-Adl, a time to regroup, assess the damage, and start rebuilding the organization from the ground up. Yet to Saif's lasting horror and amazement, some operatives, even now, hastened to carry on the fight as if nothing had happened. Foremost among them was the man whose demented vision had spawned 9/11 in the first place, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. In January of 2002, Saif al-Adl had received word that a British Islamist, Omar Sheikh, together with a crew of foot soldiers from various extremist groups, had kidnapped the Wall Street Journal's Islamabad bureau chief, Daniel Pearl, in Karachi. Saif called KSM, who was then hiding out in the city, and told him the news. These people don't know what to do with him, Saif told KSM. They want to know if we want him. Saif ordered KSM to take custody of Pearl on behalf of Al-Qaeda, but he also instructed him that it would be a bad idea to kill the hostage. KSM simply disregarded this order. Within days of the kidnapping, he had taken the journalist to an Al-Qaeda safe house, slit his throat, and beheaded him on camera in the kind of snuff video that that was shortly to become a fixture of the insurgency in Iraq, under the influence of another protege of Saif al-Adl's, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. So eager was KSM to be about his bloody business that he acted before the camera operator had put a tape into the machine. The video failed to capture the initial butchery, recording only the decapitation of Daniel Pearl's mutilated corpse. After the killing, KSM dismembered Pearl's body, buried the pieces in a shallow grave, and had the tape delivered to the Western media. Saif al-Adl was incandescent with rage. On June 13th, he sent Khalid Sheikh Mohammed the second of two vituperative letters containing an extraordinary indictment, not just of KSM, but of bin Laden himself and the blind zealotry that had dragged al-Qaeda to the brink of the abyss. He wrote, "Today we are experiencing one setback after another and have gone from misfortune to disaster. There is a new hand that is managing affairs and that is driving forcefully. Every time it falters, it gets up and rushes again, without understanding or awareness. It rushes to move without vision, and it is in a hurry to accomplish actions that now require patience because of the security activity throughout the whole world. This hand does not pay attention to what is happening, as if we will not be summoned to account before God for all these souls, this blood, and this money. The consequences that you see are nothing but an outcome of this onrush. Had I spoken before the disasters occurred, and speak I did, I would have been considered proud. But now that the matter has become a reality, I have absolved my conscience. You are the person solely responsible for all this, because you undertook the mission. And in 6 months, we have lost what took years to build." Bin Laden, Saif told the Pakistani, "pushes you relentlessly and without consideration, as if he has not heard the news and does not comprehend events. In light of the damage already done, al-Qaeda must completely halt all external actions until we sit down and consider the disaster we caused, lest the organization become a joke for all the intelligence agencies in the world. Saif ordered KSM to stop all foreign actions, stop sending people to captivity, stop devising new operations, regardless of whether orders come or do not come from Abu Abdullah." Abu Abdullah, as KSM knew very well, meant Osama bin Laden. Saif's letter was eventually made public, having been intercepted by U.S. forces. No doubt bin Laden took umbrage at the letter's explicit call for insubordination. It may be for this reason that he later disparaged Saif, who had played a pivotal role in al-Qaeda's history, as of secondary importance to Abu Muhammad al-Masri, who, as head of training, was below Saif in the hierarchy, and Abu Khair al-Masri, a Zawahiri loyalist who had only been promoted to the Shura Council when the merger with Egyptian Islamic Jihad was finalized. By any standard, the letter marks a singular moment for Saif al-Adl, the steadfast Egyptian who for so many years had played the loyal, sensible soldier struggling to corral the savage beasts filling out al-Qaeda's rank and file, had reached his breaking point. With this extraordinary letter, he had openly countermanded not just a superior officer, but the commander-in-chief himself. It was an indication of just how seriously Saif took the unfolding emergency, and of just how deep was the abyss into which he felt al-Qaeda had stumbled. In public, however, al-Qaeda's 9/11 skeptics had all fallen into line with bin Laden's exultant interpretation of events, even Abu Hafs al-Muratani, al-Qaeda's religious chief, whose original objection had been based on the Quran, changed his tune. At the end of November 2001, with the Taliban ousted from Kabul and the mountains set to quiver under Tora Bora, al-Muratani told the TV station Al Jazeera that he could not contain his joy over the attacks, as a result of which he confidently foresaw the beginning of the end for America. Saif al-Adl maintained a similar mask of defiance. Shortly before his arrest in Iran, he published two articles in which he lauded the 9/11 hijackers as heroes whose blessed operation had ignited a spark in the hearts of the youth of the Ummah. Saif lionized the heroism of those killed in the Battle of Kandahar, so-called martyrs like Hamza the Qatari. I personally felt the wonderful scent that was covering him. His face was wearing a beautiful smile, and what a smile that was, as well as Samir the Naji, who seemed very gracious and beautiful in death, despite the blood covering his body. Saif claimed victory in the ground battle for Kandahar, implicitly suggesting that the city would never have fallen were it not for the Taliban's craven unwillingness to defend it. In describing his experience of warfare against the Americans in Afghanistan, he cited a verse from the Quran. If they harm you, they can cause you but a slight hurt. And if they fight against you, they will turn their backs and run away. American soldiers, Saif still insisted, were not fit for combat. They were phonies, puffed up by Hollywood promotions, able to take territory in Afghanistan only thanks to the Northern Alliance mercenaries in their pay. The American soldier is qualified to perform cinematic roles only, Saif assured his audience. The Mujahideen are still in the battlefield, he went on, and the fight continues and will not end, God willing, until Afghanistan returns to Sharia and Islam once more. This narrative, of course, conveniently eschews all mention of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban's ignominious abandonment of Kandahar in December 2001. As he makes clear, Saif wrote principally to encourage those preparing to fight the same foe in an altogether different part of the Muslim world. We do not, by the will of God, doubt the final defeat of the American Empire. What happened in Afghanistan is only one battle. The war is still going on, and the victory is leaning towards the army of Allah. This empire of crusaders and Jews is walking to its destruction in the blessed region of the Gulf. America's invasion of Iraq came as little surprise to many members of Al-Qaeda. As far as they were concerned, apocalyptic hadith had predicted it, just as they had foretold the army of the Black Banners rising out of Khorasan. One of these hadith promised that Armageddon would not come until the Euphrates lays bare a mountain of gold. The people will fight over it, and 99 out of every 100 will be slain. For Al-Qaeda's true believers, the meaning was clear. The gold under the earth was the oil that gave the United States its reason to meddle in the Middle East time and again. By starting a war in Iraq, therefore, America was not only creating a military and diplomatic quagmire for itself and diverting much-needed resources from the unfinished conflict in Afghanistan, it was playing directly into the ideological hands of its sworn enemies. It is the night of March 20th, 2003, and the mosques and monuments of Baghdad are floodlit by the light from hundreds of explosions. American military planners have taken to terming this weaponized supernova shock and awe. In less than a month's time, U.S. forces will patrol these streets, the dictator Saddam Hussein will have been driven from power, and President George W. Bush will have declared mission accomplished from the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln. But Iraq's decade and more of violence is just getting started. By the end of August, terrorist bombs will have killed 124 people across the country, including the head of the United Nations Assistance Mission, Sergio Vieira de Mello, and dozens of Shia Muslims deliberately targeted for their faith. Soon the names Fallujah and Abu Ghraib would be on the lips of millions of people around the world, heaping yet more fuel on the wildfire of a violent insurgency. Partly in response, terrorists will release videos showing them gloating over the beheaded bodies of Western workers. Much of this carnage will be perpetrated by an organization that will pledge allegiance to Osama bin Laden and rename itself Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Its leader will be a particularly brutal pupil of Saif al-Adl, the Jordanian ex-convict Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.